Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello. Hello, good evening. Welcome to this evening's event, everyone. My name is Dr. Rachel O'Neill. I'm an assistant professor here in the Department of Media and Communications at LSE, and I'm delighted to be chairing this evening's event, which forms part of our department's public lecture program and is in fact the last of the series this year. Thank you to everyone for coming along tonight, both in person and online, and also to all those who've been attending sessions throughout the series. We're incredibly fortunate to be joined this evening by two eminent feminist scholars. Professor Sarah Benet Weiser joins us from the University of Pennsylvania, where she is Walter H. Annenberg Dean and Lauren Berlant Professor of Communication. Professor Benet Weiser is also the former head of department here at Media and Communications and is always very warmly welcome back whenever she returns, which thankfully is most summers. Professor Benet Weiser's work as a feminist media studies scholar spans a wide range of subject matter, from beauty pageants, a personal favorite of mine, to Nickelodeon television, brand culture, to commodity activism. In recent years, she has developed extremely generative analyses of the dense interrelations and insidious entanglements between popular feminism and popular misogyny. She has also, in co-authored work, pushed forward crucial new trajectories on the politics of believability, which I believe her paper will extend still further tonight. Responding to Professor Benet Weiser's talk will be Professor Angela McRobbie, Emeritus at Goldsmiths, University of London. An icon of feminist sociology and cultural studies, Professor McRobbie is known for her unparalleled ability to survey the cultural landscape and discern key shifts in its overarching topography, most especially in relation to gender and sexual politics. It's a privilege and a pleasure to have both of these scholars with us tonight. Some general points before I hand over to our speakers. First, please may I ask that you all ensure that your phones and any other devices are on silent to ensure that we do not disrupt this evening's proceedings. Second, in the event of a fire alarm, please vacate the room through the exits at the back of the theater and then proceed to the assembly points outside the main entrance of the building. Finally, on format and timings, Professor Benet Weiser will speak for approximately 40 minutes, after which Professor McRobbie will offer a response of just under 10 minutes. This evening's event is hybrid, and as such, once the talks conclude, we'll take questions from those in the room and from those joining us remotely. Those attending online should be able to enter questions into the chat, which is being monitored by our events manager, Luam Tesfe, who is at the back, thank you, and to whom we owe enormous thanks for all the work that she has put into organizing tonight's proceedings. The event is being recorded, and a podcast will hopefully be made available afterwards. Now, all that remains for me is to hand over to Professor Benet Weiser, who will deliver her talk entitled Feminism, Anti-Feminism, and Effective Economies of Rage. Please join me in welcoming her to the stage.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. Thank you, Rachel, for that introduction. Thank you, Angela, for being willing to be a respondent to this talk tonight. Thank you, all of you, for coming tonight. It's really, really great to be at the LSE. It's really, really great to not be in the United States. It's really great to be back in London. It's a Thursday night at 6:30, and you all are here, and it just was a great reminder of the incredibly vibrant intellectual community that London has to offer us. And so I'm so privileged to be here. I'm here in solidarity with all of us who remain committed to the value of higher education, to research, to science, to teaching, to freedoms of all kinds, including academic freedom. So thank you for joining me tonight. My talk is based on some new work that I've been thinking about in terms of just trying to understand the kind of cultural politics of the moment. So with that, I will start with a picture of Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni. You're welcome. That's how I'm going to start. A few months ago, the journalist Megyn Kelly gave a talk at the Conservative Political Action Conference, and bizarrely, she spent most of her time talking about the Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni case, where the actress, if you don't know about this, has accused Justin Baldoni of sexual harassment on the movie set of the movie This Ends With Us, which is a movie about domestic violence. Kelly is clearly obsessed with the case, and her personal and mean-spirited grudge against Blake Lively allowed her to make the case that this was emblematic, that this particular case of two celebrities was emblematic of what she calls the left's lies and bullying. Indeed, she calls Lively, quote, the avatar of left overreach. There's been lots of media coverage of the Blake Lively case, including a thorough investigative piece in the New York Times, who was subsequently named as a co-defendant in a $400 million defamation suit by Baldoni against Lively and the Times, along with mainstream media, social media, gossip magazines, and others. There's been a hastily made documentary on HBO. And I've tried not, actually, to pay too much attention to this case. There's some other stuff happening. I don't know if you've heard, but there is some other stuff happening, and this just couldn't really capture my attention. But I can't deny some of the similarities between it and the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp case. Both involved prominent celebrities, both involve accusations of sexual harassment or assault, both have attracted unbelievably disproportionate media attention, especially, again, when taking into consideration what else is happening in this world. So I've written with Katherine Higgins about the Heard Depp case because we thought that that was a really great example of what we call the economy of believability in the context of media and sexual violence. I can't quite bring myself to write about Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, however. So I've been thinking about why it is. What is my resistance to writing about this? I'm a media scholar, I'm a feminist. What is it that I just don't want to kind of dig my heels in? And I think it's partly because the Heard Depp trial felt as if it were a residual effect from the Me Too movement. The testimonies in that case resonated with many of the claims that were being made at the time about Me Too, that it had gone too far, that she wasn't a perfect victim, that she was a liar. But I think we've seen a cultural shift since Heard Depp, certainly not one that arose out of nowhere, but rather one that is the effect of a long durée of cultural politics that have to do with broader gender dynamics, including but not limited to sexual violence. Contra Megyn Kelly, I don't think it is Blake Lively who is the avatar of leftist overreach in the contemporary cultural climate. I think it is feminism itself that has become this avatar and the target of far-right rage. So in this talk, I want to focus on this far-right rage represented in the constructed avatar of feminism and think through how this rage, this far-right rage, engages in a mirror world with feminist rage. I'll provide some examples of those mirror worlds and hone in specifically on tradwives, because they exhibit this far-right rage precisely through construing a feminist avatar and then using this avatar as a target of their posts and their ideologies about gender. But first, let's think for a minute about what an avatar means. An avatar is a digital representation of a user, character, or person that can be used to represent oneself online in various contexts, including in video games, social media, and virtual worlds. It can be a static image. It can be a cartoon character. In case you don't know, that's Gloria Steinem, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Beyonce. It can be a 3D model, right? It's often customizable to reflect personal preferences or online identities. I'm suggesting here that a particular avatar of feminism has been created by far-right actors and circulated across multiple media platforms. This avatar has been customized to represent feminism as a series of lies, a grift, a scam, a con game. While feminism has been demonized in many different ways over centuries, as Angela's important work over the years has reminded us, the idea that it is a lie and that it is just wrong, right? Or not just wrong, that it's not just a historical relic, but it is a manipulative con game, seems to me to be a shift in its characterization. This avatar of feminism as a lie and a scam is mirrored in what is apparently the true construction of womanhood: idealized heterofemininity, commitment to a husband and children, and keeping a home. And so the current political and cultural climate has been a rich site for the construction of and attacks against a feminist avatar. When you listen to or when you view these attacks, the rage behind them is inescapable and palpable. Feminism has always been a threat to the status quo. This is not new, right? But the threat feels heightened and slightly shifted in this moment. So the rage that I'd like to talk about today is part of the architecture of this feminist avatar and its alleged overreach. This rage is often performative, but it also has very real material effects, as we will see. So rage, and anger more generally, has had a great deal of visibility in the past several years. We are in an age of anger. The media often laments the anonymous rage of the internet. We have rage baiting and now rage farming, which was kind of a new thing for me to think about. There's been lots of attention paid to gendered rage. The rage of masculinity that far-right influencers such as Andrew Tate embody, the rage that is part of the radicalization of young men online that was captured poignantly in the recent Netflix series Adolescence. We've also seen a heightened visibility of both female rage and feminist rage. The construction of that feminist avatar that I have been talking about is positioned as an object of rage. And these forms of rage aren't reducible to one another, but they are all interconnected, I'm arguing. And we need to parse them to understand their relations to one another. Writing about the media phenomenon of female anger in 2018, the reporter Leslie Jamieson remarks, "Angry women are messier than angry men. Their pain threatens to cause more collateral damage. We are most comfortable with female anger when it promises to regulate itself, to refrain from recklessness, to stay civilized." And it's precisely this messy anger that has mobilized different feminist practices over the past many decades, where rage at inequity, at lack of autonomy, at gendered and racialized violence, has motivated many to use rage as a way to challenge institutionalized and structural racism, sexism, and misogyny. Scholars such as Amiya Srinivasan, Brittany Cooper, Carol Anderson, Soraya Chemley, to name but a few, have all examined the power of women's anger in a cultural and political era that seeks to remove that power. Rebecca Traister, for example, has powerfully demonstrated that women's anger has often been at the forefront of social movements against injustice, has often been the impetus for social change. You know, 2017, but before and after, with the heightened visibility of the hashtag MeToo movement alongside a revitalized Black Lives Matter movement and other global movements that challenge social injustice, rage coursed through the veins of many and provided what Traister calls a, quote, new channel for women's furious drive. This rage was symbolized in women's marches like the ones on the screen, televised testimonies where women's bodies were put on trial. The mechanisms of repression that had historically contained that messiness of women's anger at social, political, and economic asymmetries had, it felt like, been loosened even for a moment, even for a little bit. and there was a newly felt anger, an effective economy of rage. This rage was intended to destabilize power relations. Yet, like most of us know, most efforts at destabilization, there are immediately counter mechanisms that move into action to try to contain and control this eruptive rage. These counter mechanisms mirror some of the progressive themes of feminism, but distort them so that they retrench dominant relations of power, not challenge them. As feminists on the street and on social media screamed, "Fuck the patriarchy rages back with violence by reducing bodily rights, working to reinstate and reaffirm a version of femininity that, despite its protestations, is indeed shaped by rage, but not against patriarchy, but against feminism itself." In other words, feminist rage and patriarchal counters to rage can be interpreted in a broader analytic of what I've been thinking about with different scholars and with the feminist media scholar Jilly Boyce Kay, who's here tonight, as mirror worlds. Rage emerges as a reaction to something. It's not inherently political in one direction or another. Rage can and often does engender more rage, a counter rage, a mirroring of politics. So I've recently written a short piece with Jilly Kay on mirror worlds as an analytic to try to think through cultural politics of the current moment. We wrote that we feel like we're living in this time of mirror worlds, in which topsy-turvy, new social and political formations are taking shape. Reactionary movements absorb and mirror discourses from the left, leading to perplexing new political alliances. In our contemporary mirror worlds, the familiar predicates of politics have been scrambled. Gender politics, in particular, play out with force in the digital mirror world, where we see a range of female-centric groups and influencers who have begun to mimic the rage-filled bioessentialist logics of the manosphere, a kind of reflection of a reflection. But mirrors do not simply reflect, but also refract. They can mimic a particular reality, but they can also bend and transform that reality. The mirror always transforms reality. In the mirror, we see the mirror image, which is not a pure image, but instead it's opposite, right? The Cambridge Dictionary defines the verb to mirror as to represent something honestly. Although, as any student of critical media studies knows, there never can be a neutral reflection of reality in language or media or culture. The dictionary's definition of the verb refract is to change the direction of light, sound, heat, or other energy as it travels across or through something. And so Jilly and I wrote that we might say, as our contemporary energies, our fears, our rage, our desires, our politics, right, as they travel through the terrain of networked digital media, they're reshaped and redirected, often into radically different political trajectories. As Alan Finlayson has argued, contemporary digital media is changing the ways that societal political education happens and how political concepts are understood. Again, we know this quite well at this point. It is YouTube and Reddit and TikTok and Facebook and Twitter where we increasingly come to see and do politics. And so in thinking about these mirroring processes, I've also taken inspiration in what Naomi Klein also calls a mirror world. And I argue that feminist and conservative or reactionary women are engaged in precisely such a mirror world that Klein is talking about. Klein argues that in the contemporary political moment driven by digital networks of misinformation and conspiracy theories, there is a mirroring effect between those on the political left and right. where feelings of fear, rage, and abandonment are shared, even if the origins and the realities of that fear and abandonment are different. We see this explicitly in the particular violent meme that emerged on the night of the 2024 US presidential election, when white nationalist and Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes posted on Twitter, "Your body, my choice forever." A sinister play on the feminist slogan, "My body, my choice." This violent mirroring of a feminist slogan about bodily autonomy had in a day or so been viewed more than 90 million times and been reposted more than 35,000 times. Contemporary mirror worlds also resemble what I called in 2018 the funhouse mirror of popular feminism and popular misogyny, where misogynists take up some of the themes of feminism, confidence, self-esteem, empowerment, and turn them on their heads to create men as the victims of women, and feminists, the victims of feminism, or feminists in particular, as if reflected in the distortion of a funhouse mirror. And my colleague here at the LSE, Lily Hulyarki, has brilliantly analyzed this victimhood flip in her recent book, Wronged. These are the kinds of mirror worlds that my current work focuses on, where feminist and conservative constructions of femininity, in effect, engage in common themes, but have very different solutions or reactions. Kay, in an article on what she calls reactionary feminists, continues these themes of mirroring and rage in a generative direction, making a compelling case for the ways in which reactionary feminists are those who position themselves against other versions of feminisms, especially in terms of the ineluctability of gender differences or the rejection of neoliberal feminism and its lean-in presuppositions or focus on motherhood and marriage. We see this in popular media, as in the newly launched EV magazine, the right-wing women's magazine that markets itself as the unbiased truth for women. Sorry, I just can't help it. Media, we're media scholars. It's the unbiased truth for women. The aesthetic and style of Evie mirrors other women's magazines like Cosmo and Vogue. It offers some of the same types of articles on fashion and makeup, the importance of being sexy, the art of feminine fitness, and so on. But it also offers articles and interviews that are anti-choice about kind of rigid heteronormative motherhood and about the evils of feminism. It positions itself as the corrective to the damaging lies that are spewed by traditional women's media and by feminism in particular. So you can see this is their kind of mission statement on Evie's website, where they say that we believe the only way forward is to acknowledge and celebrate those differences, those biological differences between men and women, by embracing our nature despite the world telling us we should hate the realities of our biologies and what we are. So again, positioning feminism as something, as an avatar that is about spewing hate. We also see these mirroring themes in recent US policy. Apologies for having US policy examples here. They just come so fast and furious every single day that it makes it very difficult to see outside of those. And so while there are many different examples around the world, the focus of this kind of idea of motherhood and bioessentialism is really on very recent US policy. There have been hundreds of executive orders that have been issued by the Trump administration in the first 100 days of his second term, including those that specifically focus on family and reproduction. And one such order that was intended to expand access to in vitro fertilization, it reads, my administration recognizes the importance of family formation. And as a nation, our public policy must make it easier for loving and longing mothers and fathers to have children. Indeed, Trump has taken up the issue of IVF with a cringeworthy gusto, naming himself at a recent event that ostensibly celebrated Women's History Month in the US as the, quote, fertilization president. Sorry. Lest women worry about, I don't know, you know, the removal of the rights of bodily autonomy, Trump went on in this speech to reassure us. He said, we're going to have tremendous goodies in the bag for women. The women, between the fertilization and all the other things that we're talking about, it's going to be great.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
This is an insidious mirror world. Treatments like IVF have been an important element of bodily autonomy and reproductive rights for women. In this mirror world, these rights are systematically taken away and replaced with a goodie bag for women, which is simply promised in a very vague sense to be great. Indeed, the pronatalism of the U.S. federal administration, including Trump's unelected right-hand man, Elon Musk, is part of this mirror world. Recently, the White House has discussed a variety of ideas that are intended to allow, and in some cases, encourage parents to spend more time at home with their children, including giving more money to families for each child they have, in a kind of form of an expanded tax credit for each child in a family. Feminists and other advocates for women have long been agitating for an expanded tax credit for children. However, Trump's expanded tax credit would take the money away from federal tax credits for daycare and childcare, thus implying that families would receive a tax benefit only if one parent stayed at home with the children. It doesn't take much to guess which parent that would be. Another idea floated by the administration a couple weeks ago is a $5,000 cash baby bonus to every American mother right after delivery. Surely, a $5,000 baby bonus is the same as having a second income for a family. But this is the kind of, you know, this idea that it is about having women stay at home with their children. Another proposal would reserve 30% of scholarships for the Fulbright program, the prestigious government-backed international fellowship. It would preserve 30% of those fellowships for applicants who are married and have children. In case anyone needs actual facts to provide context for these proposals, here's just a few. The majority of mothers in the United States work outside of the home in order to survive economically. The cost of childcare averages about $11,000 per child per year and is double that in most major cities in the United States. So we're talking $22,000 per child per year in the US. Again, many feminists have been agitating for years to reward reproductive labor as labor. Think of this wages for housework movement in the 1970s. But in this mirror world, rewarding reproductive labor is a move that rewards particular women, and at the expense of other policies like decent and humane maternity leave or childcare. And in this mirroring manifests in many spaces, including in how bodies are regulated and governed, especially women's bodies. Max Reed has described this shift in the federal administration as one of a sort of, quote, public policy breeding fetish. So, for the kind of final part of my talk, I'm going with this public policy breeding fetish as context. I want to delve more deeply into a very specific mirror world, the worlds of tradwives and feminists. Tradwives from the portmanteau, traditional wife, is an increasingly visible genre of lifestyle influencers on social media. There are also outside of social media, the ones, it's a capacious category. There are some tradwives that are homesteaders, that are some tradwives who are trying to escape modernity. In this talk, I'm focusing on kind of politically conservative Western tradwives on social media. The women who identify within this genre of tradwives send a deceptively simple message. Happiness for women is to be found in caring for and submitting to one's husband, having and raising children, and keeping a tidy and comfortable home. The media representation of tradwives is not new, of course, though it has reached a specific form of political visibility in the current digital media scape, where tradwife influencers have followers in the hundreds of thousands, offering their ideas and suggestions about how to get back to traditional gender roles and family dynamics. Along with my PhD student, Sarah Rennes, we have curated and analyzed a list of 50 tradwife accounts across Instagram and TikTok that have directly embraced this title of tradwife and have created posts that explicitly promote a lifestyle of traditional gender roles to their followers. The typical tradwife in the mid-21st century explicitly longs for a mythic past, where apparently men were men, women were women, and together they existed in dyads of harmony and bliss. This rose-colored past is often explicitly juxtaposed with an uncertain present, where gender identities are often blurred, where you don't know what pronoun to use, where economic success seems far out of reach for most people, and feminism continues to insist that women should be treated equally as men. Tradwives do not merely adopt this lifestyle in everyday practice, however, but broadcast this choice on social media, posting videos of themselves keeping a pristine home, cooking for a family, caring for children and a husband, although the husbands are very rarely seen in their post, if you've seen any of them, and often receiving financial benefits from sponsors, affiliate marketing, or selling their own products. Online tradwives position themselves as aspirational for their followers, yet they are not only propagating through this life through social media, but are also profiting, sometimes quite significantly, from their videos. So most of the recent popular press about tradwives, and there have been many articles, highlight the aesthetics of the women that they are profiling, their commitment to motherhood and marriage, their seeming self-sacrifice, and their hostility to feminism. These media stories often revolve around a few highly visible women who have followers in the millions, often inherited wealth, and a perfected profile on social media. Does anyone recognize any of these tradwives up here? Okay, so we've got Hannah Nealman from Ballerina Farm, Nara Smith. These media stories, again, they often revolve around these few highly visible women who have followers in the millions, right? And it certainly these highly visible tradwives have captured public attention, but we tried in this work to kind of broaden the discussion to have a sort of bring in a larger range of influencers, of kind of everyday influencers. This networked collective of tradwife influencers, we argue, fit within what Lauren Berlant called intimate publics. Women's culture, they convincingly point out, is often characterized by a discourse of disappointment in societal and cultural expectations of women, leading to their concept of cruel optimism, where women invest in conditions that are designed, literally designed, to marginalize them. The intimate public of tradwives revolves around heteronormativity and domestic bliss, but also, again, emphasizes that this domestic bliss is the response to the cruel optimism of living in a capitalist world that pays lip service to gender equality. In other words, tradwives unify around yet another, again, another very specific theme, their hostility towards feminism, often to the point where they blame feminists explicitly rather than the patriarchy for numerous breakdowns in society. And so this is just one of the tradwife accounts that we looked at where it says, you know, it blames kind of feminism and feminist theory, that it's a philosophy of bitterness, that all feminists at some point in their lives chose to nurse their grievances and nurture their hearts until they grew into demonic rage machines that could no longer be reasoned with. I kind of think that I'm going to use that as my signature in my email from now on. Like Sarah Bonet Weiser, demonic rage machine that cannot be reasoned with. So this is the kind of tone of these accounts. So in this work, we look at different breakdowns in society, including the myth of the girl boss or hustle culture, including the lack of care networks and social service networks. Today, in keeping with some of the other examples, I'm going to talk about the breakdown in terms of the devaluing of reproductive labor. One of the most prominent themes of tradwife accounts is this devaluation of reproductive labor. Again, tradwives rage again and again against the tendency to devalue and dismiss reproductive labor. This critique has long been a central tenet of feminist thought. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the wages for housework movement addressed this very concern through powerful transnational organizing in the 1970s. Feminist theories of social reproduction emphasize this point, arguing that the gendered relationships that are involved in maintaining people through childcare, domestic work, and other forms of invisible labor are key to the continuation of capitalism. Yet this labor, as many of us know, is not valued within capitalism. The devaluation of gendered labor instead solidifies gendered divisions of labor and intensifies patriarchal norms. Capitalism has worked historically to retrench male dominance, not subvert it. Tradwives, however, selectively draw out some contorted components of this feminist lineage while spotlighting the systematic devaluation of women's work in the home. However, they take a sharp detour from the radical roots of this thinking and instead lean into reductive bioessentialism that makes motherhood a predestined calling for women's true feminine nature. In other words, while historically feminists have sought to denaturalize invisible labor and position it as explicitly political, tradwives seek to renaturalize this gendered labor and position it as a sacred duty. Right, and so you can see, you know, these are just a couple of screenshots from some of the tradwives' accounts, you know, that are about kind of talking about motherhood as a sacred duty. Silvia Federici in 1975 famously claimed, "They say it is love. We say it is unwaged work." Twisting this notion, tradwives insist it is both. For tradwives, the degradation of reproductive labor is only solved by elevating motherhood as the only noble vocation for women. Homemaking is as much a job as any paid position. As evidenced by the wages for housework movement, the radical potential of such a claim should not be dismissed. However, this statement, taken from a tradwife's Instagram post, does not stop there and continues by saying, quote, "I have a job given to me by the Lord and a duty to my people." By pairing together these statements, devalued domestic labor does not warrant compensation or a rethinking of systemic support, but instead requires humble submission to this holy calling. Indeed, distorted echoes of feminist notions of reproductive labor are strangely present across tradwife content. Many statements from tradwives have a level of concordance with the notion that was distilled by a highly circulated poster from the Sea Red Women's Workshop in 1975. "Capitalism also depends on domestic labor," that poster said. Repeatedly, tradwives call attention to how their unwaged labor forms the scaffolding for society. And here are just a couple of different, pull quotes from tradwives' account. "Being a housewife is honorable and worthy of respect, vital to the functioning of society. Stay-at-home moms know that they will be looked down upon. We also know that what we do isn't making money, but we know that some of the most valuable, impactful work in this world isn't paid." These are really really important statements, right? And these arguments do demand respect for reproductive labor, but they also accept the idea that this is a woman's natural and necessary role. In an attempt to rescue domestic labor from disregard, tradwives overcorrect and construct it as a feminine destiny. Feminists seek to make invisible labor visible and attach a wage to domestic work. And yet, in a strange twist, tradwives' insistence on filming, uploading, and monetizing their content on social media does deliver some semblance of visibility and monetization, albeit in vastly varying degrees and with a lot of precarity. But the similarities end there. Where feminists, again, seek or wish to denaturalize the idea that women are destined to perform reproductive labor, tradwives seek to not only renaturalize it, but supernaturalize it. Reproductive labor is a God-given duty and thus must be embraced as such. Such a framing then positions any resistance to this role as a deeply selfish and misguided desire. In contrast to a feminist framing of this issue as a political struggle, tradwives advocate acceptance. As a smiling woman in front of a laundry machine states, quote, "No matter how much society tries to convince me to hold on to my conditioned anger, I will not fall for it. Because I know all good things take mercy and forgiveness and what blessings my role holds." Resistance to reproductive labor or to the invisibility of reproductive labor, whether that be in the form of agitating for reproductive rights, an insistence on an equal division of domestic labor or equality in the workplace, is thus construed as a path of conditioned anger and one that shirks mercy and forgiveness and blessings. In this mirror world, feminist calls to negotiate the value of child rearing and domestic labor are turned into betrayal. Quote, "Modern day feminists are not fighting for equality. They're fighting against women. They're fighting to strip us from traditional feminine desires and beauty," states a text overlay on a video of a woman dancing in front of a clothesline. "They are fighting to make childbearing insignificant and boring, when reality it is the most important job in the world." Here, doubling down on the conditions of submissive womanhood is presented as the only way to elevate women from a degraded status. Continuing the association of feminism with capitalist logics, tradwives also blame feminism as the reason that motherhood is degraded. In another quote, another post, they say, "It's obvious that the women who founded the feminist movement did not value motherhood, nor see it as a legitimate contribution to society, but neither does feminism today." She continues, "This wasn't just a past sentiment. The roots were rotten, and so is the fruit." So a false binary becomes pervasive. And from this vantage point, embracing traditional gender roles is the only space where reproductive labor enjoys the honored status it deserves. In the mirror world of tradwives, feminism is construed as the force that pushes domestic labor into a sphere of unimportance and invisibility. It is constructed as an avatar that is the target of their rage. Focusing on making invisible labor visible, tradwives take a potentially liberatory premise and twist it into a regressive conclusion. For this group, it's not the case that domestic care work should be valued more by society as work, but only as a calling. This focus on individualizing and naturalizing invisible labor is precisely the opposite of feminist calls for a theory of social reproduction and a recognition of a crisis of care. So this rageful reaction of the far right to feminism manifests in tradwives, who are one of the conduits for generating this kind of mirror world that I'm looking at, where female rage is transformed into idealized femininity, and feminism, again, becomes a lie, a con, an avatar. So, to wrap up, again, as I wrote recently with Jilly Kay, feminist ideas and reactionary politics are being mixed and matched in the current digital moment. They're scrambled and recomposed in a hall of mirrors, leading to anti-feminism and nihilistic anti-politics. In that piece, we insisted that on rejecting anti-politics as a way to engage in those struggles. Tradwives who insist that feminism is a lie and a con, these practices center despair and counter hope. Media scholar Wendy Chun has recently written about the contemporary political and technological landscape, which she sees as characterized by what she calls, quote, the sadistic mirroring of progressive politics. This is a mirroring that is fundamentally about despair and cruelty. Chun argues that the current climate represents what she deems a shift from masochism to sadism, arguing that this sadistic culture is, quote, focused on demonstration, on showing how reasoning itself is a form of violence, on negation as the absolute idea of reason, on always being right. So the question I'm asking when I look at gender digital culture, when I look at these things, when I look at the kind of heightened visibility of different things like EV Magazine or Tradwives and so on, is what's at stake in thinking of the current moment as one of, quote, sadistic mirroring of progressive politics? A few months ago, I was on a panel at the Society for Cinema and Media Studies with some amazing colleagues who are in this room, Rachel O'Neill, Sami Dosakhan. Our panel was titled, What is Feminism Anymore? In this talk, I've admittedly been a bit loose with the term feminism. It's clearly a capacious category and does not mean one thing at one historical moment. But even in its narrower identifications, feminism is riven with ambivalence. That's what we discussed on that panel. The current multiple manifestations of feminism, particularly but not exclusively in the media, are rife with contradictions, challenges, and a deep ambivalence. As Claire Hemmings has argued, feminist political ambivalence structures feminist practice and contains both the conditions of possibility and the conditions for limiting those very practices. So in that same panel, the feminist media scholar Helen Wood asked a question that has lived in my head in an endless loop ever since. What is, she asked, what is the future that is envisioned by reactionary feminists, by this kind of sadistic mirroring, this and cruelty of contemporary politics? And what is the future that is envisioned by those of us who reject this kind of rage? Anne Helen Peterson, in a recent post, made a very good point saying, quote, it's so much easier to market rage than care. I've written a fair bit about marketing and branding, and I think a lot about why it's easy to market rage. Shame and humiliation and cruelty are easy weapons to wield. Care and compassion are much harder and much trickier. So for me to answer Helen, part of that future involves care and compassion. It's not about calling people idiots. It's not mean-spirited. It's not cruel or sadistic. It's more about what Miriam Kaba calls, quote, active hope. She says that in order to practice active hope, we need not to believe that everything is going to work out in the end. We need only to decide who we are choosing to be and how we are choosing to function in relation to social change and the kind of social change that we want to be a part of. To make feminism into an avatar that is the target of rage is about marketing rage. It is about rejecting active hope. Feminism is a politics. For me, feminism is a politics and a praxis. We don't need to continue to market rage. We don't need to give in to cruelty and sadism. And I think that actually, that's why I don't want to write about Blake Lively. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.